This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The conclusion of the Zacharias Moussaoui trial reopens the debate on terrorism trials, with Moussaoui himself on both sides. In a parting shot in court, he declared, "America lost." But then, in an improbable attempt to withdraw his guilty plea, he praised the jury that sentenced him to life in prison and said that he could get a fair trial in America. Moussaoui, like most of those tried for terrorism, is a relatively minor figure. Senior al-Qaeda operatives like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who planned 9/11, may never face trial. Depending on who you ask, that's because he's more valuable as a source of information, because a trial would involve the disclosure of secrets, or because any legal case has already been hopelessly compromised by aggressive interrogation that many regard as torture. Our main focus this hour is prosecution of terror suspects, why it's so tricky, whether we're on the right track, and how to make the system better. Later on in the program, our weekly Wednesday fix with our political junkie. If you have questions about the West Virginia and Nebraska primaries yesterday, the Florida Senate race, another guilty plea in the Abramoff investigation, or other political news, send us email now. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, trying terrorists. Can high-level suspects be tried at all? Is it better to create informants or defendants? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. We begin with David Savage, legal correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, who's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back, David.
Hi, Neil.
Has the government, what's the record thus far in prosecuting terror suspects?
Well, they've had a reasonable record of convicting rather minor players. There have been a series of these prosecutions brought against men who traveled to Afghanistan to visit a terrorist camp, came back to the U.S. in Lackawanna or Detroit. They didn't actually do anything in the United States, but they were prosecuted for allegedly giving, quote, material support to terrorism. And so the government has, in a sense, won a lot of cases involving very minor players. As you mentioned, though, they have not really gone after the big fish to prosecute them.
Mm-hmm.
This is an area where, like so much in the Bush administration, I think the Pentagon and Vice President Cheney have really been calling the shots. And from the very beginning, they have been interested in grabbing people, holding them in secret, questioning them with the idea of, we want to get intelligence out of these people to prevent future or further attacks. We're much less interested in prosecuting them. So there's been this, from the public's point of view, there's been this strange dichotomy between the big fish are sort of held somewhere and not prosecuted, and then there's a series of trials of people, Moussaoui was a good example of it, who was in some way, distant. He was in jail at the time of 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Then there are, you mentioned people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib, big fish, if you will, being held, we don't know where, in a CIA prison somewhere. There are others being held at Guantanamo, and they could be facing military tribunals. That's still up in the air.
Yes. President Bush said the other day, and some of the Justice Department people have talked about this, is that depending on what the Supreme Court does in the Hamdan case, you remember they have a case right now sort of testing the government's plans for military tribunals. If the Supreme Court were to uphold that system, I take it the government's view is that, well, now maybe we could then possibly bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and some of these other people to Guantanamo and try them in a military tribunal.
Mm-hmm. One of the oddities of the Moussaoui case, and again, he confessed, and his trial was a sentencing trial, whether he would get life in prison or the death penalty. But one of the witnesses against him, in an odd sort of way, was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who his testimony was presented, a statement by him was presented, but he was not available to be cross-examined.
I think everything regarding the Moussaoui case was an oddity. You remember he, at several times, would go to plead guilty to some conspiracy and then tell the judge, by the way, judge, I want you to know I didn't actually do the things I'm pleading guilty to today. But yes, I mean, if I were a juror in the Moussaoui case, it would have been most odd to be sitting there. You're debating whether to send this guy to death for the 9/11 crime, and you're being read a 58-page statement by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed talking about how he masterminded the whole plan. He sold bin Laden on the plan. He planned, where the planes were going to go. And by the way, Moussaoui was sort of a non-participant. We saw him as unreliable. Maybe he'd be in the second wave. So, yes, it was extremely odd to have the mastermind testifying sort of offstage somewhere in a case involving a sort of wannabe who wasn't actually part of the 9/11 plot.
Then there's the case of Jose Padilla. Again, that's the right pronunciation. But Jose Padilla, who, when he was arrested, was alleged to have been involved in plots to set off a dirty bomb and blow up buildings in New York City. Yet, after a long legal wrangle, we've been through that before, but after a long legal wrangle, he does get charged in civilian court, but with crimes that have nothing to do with those charges.
Yes, and I think the only way to explain that is what we were talking about earlier. That is, once again, when the government saw somebody who they thought was important, they grabbed him, held him in secret, put him in a military brig, did not want to charge him with a crime, held him for 3 years.
Did not want to have him to have a lawyer.
Did not want to have a lawyer, didn't want to have anybody speak to him, because their concern was, if there is this dirty bomb plot, we want to get the information. But having done that for 3 years, they basically made it impossible to then go back and prosecute him for this alleged dirty bomb plot. And now he's being tried on relatively minor charges. He will be tried on relatively minor terrorism charges down in Florida. So it's the same thing. The people who they think are important don't get prosecuted. The more minor figures do get prosecuted.
And if you think about all of the mafia trials that we've become accustomed to reading about in the newspapers, or perhaps more accustomed to seeing on the television set, but anyway, it's always you get the little fish to get the big fish. This seems to be standing that on its head.
Yes, at least so far. It's been the little fish and nothing more. You know, we don't know how this will play out with the people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but it certainly looks like it's possible that they will never be prosecuted, at least never be prosecuted in a standard civilian court in the United States.
Conceivably, they could end up at one of these military tribunals if they're legal, if they go ahead, if all of that happens.
Yes, that's possible.
And as we look at all of this, do we risk, in some senses, all the trials we've seen, again, of these relatively minor figures, and there have been also cases, the case in Florida where a defendant was acquitted of some charges, hung jury on others, hung jury in a case in Lodi, California. Does that tend to somehow trivialize or delegitimize some of these great allegations against some of these terrible figures?
Well, to the extent that John Ashcroft, for example, particularly tended to inflate all these cases. It was always that the government was disrupting a major terrorism cell or breaking up some major plot, when at the end of the day you come up with fairly minor prosecutions or people even being acquitted in fairly minor prosecutions, it leads you to wonder, well, wait a minute, what was going on here? Was there really a big terrorism plot in the first place? I suppose try to be fair to Ashcroft, is that early on, after 9/11, they really did think there were a lot of terrorism cells in the United States. 4 years, 5 years into it, you really wonder whether there really were a lot of terrorists actually operating in the United States, and maybe that's why they don't have a lot of people to prosecute and try.
David Savage, thanks very much for being with us. David Savage, the legal correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, joined us here in Studio 3A in Washington, D.C. Always appreciate your time, David. Let's turn now to David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University. He's also with us here in Studio 3A. And Professor Cole, one of the things that people would immediately cite is after the first World Trade Center bomb attack back in 1993, the principal figures in that were arrested, were tried. Sure, secrets were involved. Sure, it was tricky, but they were convicted, and they're doing time in prison.
That's right, and I think what that shows is that you can try terrorists in civilian court with criminal charges. It's not easy, but you can do it, and we have done it. The blind sheikh is serving multiple life sentences for planning to for conspiring to blow up tunnels and bridges around Manhattan. They didn't have to wait until the bridges and tunnels blew up. They brought charges on the basis of conspiracy. They convicted him, and they put him away for life through a fair trial. And I think what's important about that is that if you do it through a fair trial, the world doesn't see it as illegitimate. We don't see massive protests about the fact that the blind sheikh is serving a life sentence without parole in the United States. We do see massive protests about what's happening at Guantanamo, what's happening in our CIA black sites and the like, where we are denying people any kind of process, any kind of fair process whatsoever.
And the difference, a lot of people would say, is, well, one was before 9/11, the rest are after.
Well, that many people would say that, but I think the rule of law applies both before and after, certainly ought to apply both before and after. And I think the rule of law gives the government quite broad leeway in how to respond to the threat of terror, which unfortunately our government has seen as a hindrance, as an obstacle. So, for example, we don't have to try all the al-Qaeda terrorists in criminal proceedings. We can, under the laws of war, detain them. We can detain them for the duration of the conflict with al-Qaeda. We simply have to give them a fair hearing to make sure that they actually are al-Qaeda. We have to treat them humanely once we hold them, and we can only hold them for the duration of the conflict with al-Qaeda. What the administration has done is said, we're not going to abide by even those minimal restrictions. We're not going to give them any hearing whatsoever until the Supreme Court says you have to. We're not going to treat them humanely. Instead, we're going to subject them to the kinds of interrogation tactics that that the world sees as torture, even if Donald Rumsfeld doesn't. And we're not going to assert the right to hold them till the war with al-Qaeda is over. We're going to assert the right to hold them forever. When Donald Rumsfeld said, how long can they be held? He said, until the there are no longer any terrorist organizations of global reach left in the world. That's an assertion that we can hold them forever, no hearings, and we can torture them while we're doing it. Mm-hmm. That fails to abide by the rule of law and I think undermines our efforts to keep ourselves secure by just generating tremendous amounts of anti-Americanism around the world. Mm-hmm.
Zacharias Moussaoui will spend the rest of his life in jail for his role in the 9/11 attacks, a victory for the government, but what's the overall U.S. strategy for prosecuting terrorists? Some terrorism suspects were tried for lesser offenses. Others are held in confinement and may never be tried. Our guest is David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, author of Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And now let me introduce Bruce Fine, a constitutional lawyer and international consultant with Bruce Fine and Associates in the Litchfield Group. He served in the Reagan administration's Justice Department, also with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being
with us
today. As you look at this, is there going to be an opportunity to try these top terrorism suspects? Is the government right to regard them as more valuable as informants and to completely reject their value as defendants?
Well, the answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no. Let me give you an example from the post-World War II days when we were prosecuting those who were involved in stealing the atomic bomb and sharing it with the Soviet Union. There was a fellow named Ted Hall, mm-hmm. who we had able to identify by cracking the Venona code that the Soviet Union was using, and it was decided not to prosecute him, even though the guilt was clear because we'd have to disclose to the Soviets that we had broken a code and would alert them to all sorts of intelligence we had against them. And so that was a prudential choice not to go forward, even though a case could have been made. With regard to the high-level folks, the fact are, other than the two you've mentioned, we don't have Osama bin Laden. We don't have Zarqawi. I don't understand the idea that suddenly we've got this huge circle and universe of high-level folks that we're just sitting on doing nothing. With regard to the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, the fact is they are being held as illegal combatants. And as David pointed out, in times of war, when you're in that status, you don't have to be committed a crime in order to be detained. During World War II, when we captured Nazi soldiers or Japanese, we didn't give them trials. We held them as prisoners. No one knew how long the war would last, whether it would last 5 years, 10 years, or whatever. But they would be held indefinitely until there was a conclusion. And that's the status of the Guantanamo Bay detainees. Some of them, in addition to being detained as illegal combatants, are being charged with war crimes. Whether that offers additional punishment, since, as David points out, if you hold them indefinitely and the war on terrorism isn't in sight, whether the punishment adds anything to the current status is hard to know. I think that David was a little bit too harsh on the administration. Not, I don't think, in terms of their spirit, but in terms of how the law has evolved from the outset. There was an amendment, as David knows, sponsored by Lindsey Graham of the Senate, that now entitles any Guantanamo Bay detainee to challenge the constitutionality of the hearing hearing process in Guantanamo Bay to determine whether they're an illegal combatant or not in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. So they're not denied all access. There's obviously the anti-torture statute that was enacted by Congress that prohibits interrogation that's not only torturous but would be inhumane, degrading, or cruel. So those are efforts, I think, that do bring the United States closer into international norms, and I think is something to be applauded. Overall, I don't think there is any clear strategy between indefinitely detaining those who are involved in the war or trying them in criminal cases, because if you satisfy due process in the criminal cases, and you can, oftentimes you must disclose intelligence sources and methods to give the defendant a fair trial. And as in the case of Theodore Hall and the stealing of the atomic secrets, it may not be worth the candle in order to do that. I think it is very clear that after 9/11, the whole idea that was attempted to be injected into the FBI is you should no longer look at yourself as an organization that goes and captures the culprit after a crime is committed. Your primary goal is to prevent the crime at the outset, mm-hmm. which means that's intelligence gathering and not so much concerned as an organization with prosecutions after the fact. That's a decision whether or not the criminal justice punishment adds something that's more important than just intelligence so that you can thwart crimes is a decision that isn't like Euclidean geometry. People can disagree about the proportion you put on intelligence as opposed to criminally punishing afterwards.
Ted Hall was allowed to emigrate, lived in Britain, and worked for the rest of his mm-hmm. life as a professor. He was not held incommunicado and aggressively questioned for the rest of his life. What about, as David Cole suggested, what about the rule of law?
But that's different because he was not ever found to be an illegal combatant during war. If he were, then he could have been held indefinitely. The people at Guantanamo Bay, subject to the protections of the Graham Amendment to challenge the constitutionality of the Civilian Review Tribunal in Guantanamo Bay, have an opportunity to show they're not an illegal combatant, but under the law, the rule of law, if you are in that status, the governing power is entitled to detain you till the war ends, just like those Nazis that we captured and weren't given trials. They were held until the war concluded.
All right. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255, and we'll begin with Mark. Mark calling from Boston.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Okay.
I wanted to point out that Mr. Savage's suggestion that in speculation about what the reasons for the government's behavior in these matters includes the second item, which he said was protection of secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the secrets are unspecified, but it seems to me that given the extreme secrecy that was enforced in even the penalty phase of the Mousavi trial is an indication of how desperate they are to protect an otherwise untenable position. Where essentially agents, that is, Justice Department attorneys and potentially military prosecutors and attorneys, are prosecuting pawns, people who have been hired to carry out an overreaching policy of the United States. And, you know, the fiction that is presented to the public cannot stand the scrutiny of a trial with cross-examination. They do anything to prevent that from happening.
David Cole, is that what you suspect?
Well, I think secrecy obviously has a role to play when you're in a military conflict. You have a legitimate interest in not telling the opponent everything you know about them. But I also think that there was a real where the rubber really hits the road is that once you have subjected a person to waterboarding, as we have reportedly done with respect to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and presumably worse, once you have disappeared someone for years at the time, which is what we've done to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you can't afford to bring him into any kind of public forum, because that forum will turn into a trial of the United States. And so the government fought like hell to keep Khalid Sheikh Mohammed out of the Zacharias Mousavi trial. The issue there was that he had evidence that was exculpatory as to Mousavi. It showed that he was a pawn. He wasn't, in fact, seriously involved or involved at all in 9/11. And the government wanted to go ahead and seek to execute Mousavi without even allowing Mr. Muhammad to testify whatsoever. So, you know, I think there the desire for secrecy, which has led to secret detention centers, has led to secret torture policies, has led to thousands of secret arrests, both in the United States after 9/11 and at Guantanamo. There's some legitimate interest, but we've gone way overboard. And what we've done by employing these broad tactics is we have undermined our credibility around the world.
The arguments that David made in theory, I think, are correct, but I don't think they apply in Moussaoui's case. Sheikh Khalid's evidence was exculpatory and came in with regard to Moussaoui, even though Moussaoui himself disputed them.
Over that government objections.
The government appealed repeatedly to keep him out of court, and they let the statements in, but not the person to testify.
Yes, but there isn't any evidence that Moussaoui thought that Khalid would provide more favorable evidence if he was there and subject to cross-examination, because Moussaoui was saying, I was a more prominent player. I deserve more culpability because I was more at the center of the plot of 9/11 than Khalid was saying. But to go back to David's point, it is a matter of balance here between the need for secrecy and the need for fairness and due process. And the balance is different when you're holding someone as an illegal combatant during wartime as opposed to criminally prosecuting them. And I think that's an enormous distinction to make with regard to the traditions of wartime and international law.
Mark, thanks very much. Let's go now to this is Jeff. Jeff's calling us from Philadelphia.
Yeah, I was wondering why we wouldn't turn this over to the World Court at The Hague and perhaps restore some of our credibility and let them sort it out.
International Court, these are, in a very real sense, international crimes, Bruce Fine.
The World Court does not have automatic jurisdiction over international crimes. There's an International Criminal Court that was created, but we are not signatories to that. And moreover, even under that covenant, it's only if you are not prosecuting the crimes in an adequate way yourself, are you then required to submit a criminal defendant to the International Criminal Court? But it's very clear, not being a signatory, in fact, we've gone out of our way to ensure that other nations will not report any of our soldiers to the International Criminal Court. That would be the last place that we would send any of these detainees.
Mm-hmm. David Cole, is that a realistic alternative?
Well, it's not a realistic alternative under this administration, but that's part of the problem. The reason we're not willing to be a part of the International Criminal Court is we don't want to be held responsible. We don't want our people to be held responsible when they violate the laws of war and the like. And so it's all part of a pattern in which we are perceived around the world as not being willing to play by the rules that everybody else has to play by, whether they're international law, whether it's international criminal law, whether it's the laws of war. We've taken the position we're not going to be subject to it. That's as the Pentagon said in a memo last year, that's a strategy of the weak. We're strong. We don't have to follow the rule of law. That, to me, is the biggest problem in the administration's approach to the war on terror, and it is the biggest reason why we have gone from having the world's sympathy on 9/11 to a situation in which there's never been more stronger anti-Americanism around the world than there is today.
Mm. Jeff?
All I can say is amen to that.
All right, Jeff. Thanks. Thanks very much for the phone call. If the peculiarity of the non-state character of an organization like Al-Qaeda, it's not charging the person who headed the Nazi Germany's Justice Department, or so-called Justice Department. It puzzles people that these people seem to be criminals who have committed criminal acts for which others have been tried in criminal court, Bruce Fine, and yet they're not likely to be tried at all.
Well, that's because we're in this peculiar situation of defining a new kind of warfare that's in some sense unprecedented, because we don't have a nation that we're fighting. There's not going to be a surrender of Robert E. Lee to U.S. Grant. There's not going to be a surrender on the USS Missouri. And the fact is that if you're fighting a war, not being involved in a combatant is not a crime under international law. And the reason why they would never be subject to trial is the same reason why we had many hundreds of thousands of Japanese, Italian, Nazi prisoners in World War II. They were never subject to a trial either. They were detained. No one knew whether the detention would be 5 years, 10 years, however the war was going to act. Suppose we didn't develop the atomic weapon. The Japanese warfare could have continued for long, long years. So that there's nothing unusual about that score. I think what's unique here is that we aren't really comfortable with defining what's going on as a war, although that's what we're doing, because our national security isn't at stake. We don't have a formal army that we're opposing. And that's why I think some of the thinking remains very tentative and I think a little bit disturbing, because we sense that wartime character of this is a little bit too stark, but it's not typical civilian kind of criminal problem either.
Constitutional lawyer Bruce Fine, also with us, David Cole, a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Bill. Bill's with us from Arlington, Virginia.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the president took an oath of office to uphold the laws and the Constitution of the United States. We have laws to handle people, whether it's citizens, illegal combatants, or whoever they are. If they break our laws and we capture, we can drive in our courts. And, hello, can you still hear me?
Yes, you're still on the air.
And that's the president's job. His job is to carry out the laws of the United States. And when he doesn't do that, he subjects himself to impeachment. I mean, he has broken the laws, and he should be, the possibility he could be tried for breaking our laws and be impeached for doing something like he's done.
Is this in any sense illegal, Bruce Fine?
I don't think that what he's doing with regard to his principles with regard to detaining illegal combatants indefinitely is illegal. I've criticized him for other things he's doing illegal, like warrantless surveilling American citizens on American soil. But in these areas here, you may have a particular infraction where an incident of torture occurs that's in violation of law, but we don't, in my judgment, have the clear proof that the president himself is sanctioning, endorsing, and not trying to take some kind of remedial action. Certainly, it isn't the rise to the level of a criminal violation, which is what is true with regard to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, David Cole?
Well, I think he's broken a number of laws. I think, and Bruce agrees with me on this, that he's clearly violated the law in ordering warrantless wiretapping on Americans.
I think we'll get to General Hayden's nomination next week.
Right. I think he also violated the law in asserting the power to hold enemy combatants without any review whatsoever by the courts or Congress, which is the position he took in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court rejected virtually unanimously. And I think he's violated the law by authorizing tactics of interrogation, which include making people think they're drowning, which include injecting people with IV fluids until they urinate on themselves, which include forcing people to be naked and wear women's underwear and bark like dogs and be on leashes. All of that authorized officially by this administration, all of it, I think, in clear violation of criminal laws and international treaties. And again, it's this notion. He takes the position, because I'm commander-in-chief, I don't have to follow these laws because I get to say how we engage the enemy. Nobody else does. Not Congress, not the courts, not the world at large.
All right. Let's see if we can... Bill, by the way, thanks very much. Let's see if we can get one last call in. This is Drew. Drew in Wichita, Kansas.
Hi, thank you. You just hit on something very explicit that I hope you can elaborate on. We have things in our system that are defined by law. They say that you have to, very specific terms. People are called back into service and compelled to serve if we are at a time of war. The president has wartime acts, or powers, rather. Without a declaration of war, without a formal acknowledgement, how do we set ourselves to where we can say when somebody does and doesn't have these powers?
Were the acts passed by Congress, Bruce Fine, equivalent to a declaration
of war? Yes, the authorization to use military force was pretty explicit on that score. I want to respond to one thing that David said, and I'm not trying to justify some of the outlandish arguments that the president made with regard to illegal combatants, but he did comply with the Supreme Court decree. And he didn't say, I'm going to ignore what the court has told me to. And with regard to some of the abuses, Abu Ghraib being illustrative, in the interrogation phase, there are prosecutions that are ongoing. There's nothing that suggests there's an official policy to exonerate anybody who undertook these rather squalid acts of interrogation.
May I ask, does this, as you said, this, does it, so you said this, the thing that we passed, it doesn't actually say we're at war, But doesn't that set a bad precedent to go ahead and say, well, we didn't actually do the thing, but it's kind of close?
Drew, we're running out of time. All I can say is that the precedent has been set long after 1941. We have not declared war since then. We've been involved in a few wars, so I think the precedent has been well established for good or ill. Anyway, I'd like to thank our guest, Bruce Fine of the Bruce Fine and Associates, and David Cole of Georgetown University Law Center for being with us. Political Junkie, when we come back from the break, I'm Neil Cohn. It's NPR News.